Thank you, Jung, for the introduction, and let me also thank the organizers for enabling us to meet at an in-person conference. Right, so today I want to present some of the latest research I've done in collaboration with Eros Berg and Debanjan Chaudhuri. And we were interested in superconductivity in flat bands. At the first motivation, but it really is more of a motivation and less of a realistic modeling, we started from twisted bilayer graphene, where you have flat bands close to the Fermi surface. And I guess it's surprising, you do find superconductive regions in the phase diagram. And to me, this is surprising for two competing energy scales. On one hand, for superconductivity, you need to pair electrons into Cooper pairs, but you also have to establish long-range phase coherence for superconductivity. And typically, if you optimize one energy scale, it comes at the expense of another one. So for example, if you were to increase the Hubbard interaction U, attractive Hubbard interaction for pair binding, further and further, at some point you start localizing your electrons, your Cooper pairs, and it's more and more difficult to establish long-range phase coherence. And this is showing up that first, if the interaction is weaker than the dispersion, the bandwidth, it's the exponential scale because the superconducting TC is dominated by the phase coherence. But then if U is very large, TC is dropping again like 1 over U because you essentially start to localize Cooper pairs. Now, here you have extremely small kinetic energies, so why do you still get superconductivity? And to study this further, we have a setup where we will be focusing on flat bands in the vicinity of the chemical potential, and then we ask various questions. So for example, what is the ground state in this setup, in particular if we go to the strong coupling limit? And then also, once you have found a certain ground state, you should ask, is it a robust state or is it easy to perturb the system and find different phases? For example, there could be phase separation, charge order, or combination of different phases. And then it would be natural to investigate what defines and determines the competition between different kinds of ordering. And since pretty much by definition we are looking at flat bands, we are in a regime of strongly coupled electrons, so mean field theory is probably not the best way to go. And what is surprising, or what people discovered a few years ago, is that even in the limit of perfectly flat bands where the electrons are localized, Cooper pairs can actually still delocalize and start hopping as a pair itself. And this gives rise to a fundamentally different scaling of the critical temperature of the superconductivity. Namely, it's expected to be linear in U, pretty much because the interaction is the main energy scale of the Hamiltonian. And this is in contrast both to the exponential onset, but also to the 1 over U behavior. So one of the questions is, why does this happen? Where is this, or what is special about those bands?
Can I ask a naive question?
Sure.
This might be super naive, but if I just stare at this naively, I would think maybe the U induces some
effective
bandwidth.
You might think so. So the question was, how do I know, or why is U not inducing an effective bandwidth? That I start with flat bands, but as an interaction effect, the band is renormalized and we have a finite dispersion, and then we are back to the more conventional picture. I don't have a generic answer, one doesn't know how interactions renormalize the band. But what I will hopefully convince you in the rest of the talk, this is not the mechanism that we find here. We will find a renormalization of the bandwidths, but it will introduce a different kind of physics, and it doesn't help to explain TC being linear to you. So one system that we started out with already actually 2 years ago is we were looking at churn bands, where the band has a non-trivial topology, and we have a system where we have two bands. In the upper case, it's a little bit more dispersive, even though the dispersion compared to the bandwidth or the band gap between those two bands is already quite small. But then we found a way to tune the dispersion even further and make the lower band really, really flat. And it's a two-band system of spinful electrons. So overall, I could have four particles per unit cell. And we are interested in roughly one particle per unit cell, such that the lower band is at about half filling, so quarter filling overall. And what we found, and which I briefly want to recapture here, is that on one hand, for the dashed line, this is the flat scenario, we find a critical temperature which scales pretty much linear with U, so this is the interaction strength U, and the bandwidth is, I think, around 0.7 here, and then considerably smaller in this lower case. So the interaction is quite larger than the bandwidth by quite an amount. And the other thing that we found is, I don't want to go into the details, so let me just quote it. There is a pseudo-gap phase in the sense that there are strong pairing and charge fluctuations. And in particular, for the dispersive case, we don't see any signs of a Fermi surface above TC. So the higher temperature regime is covered by density and pairing fluctuations. And then we find this linear or almost linear in U behavior in an unbiased way. So the lessons that we have learned here is, on one hand, yes, we can find superconducting even in flat bands. We found a strongly fluctuating phase above TC. One can actually understand this to identify an approximate SU2 symmetry, which explains both the density and the pairing correlations. But one has to be a little bit careful, because if the SU2 symmetry was exact, then Merman-Wagner would tell us that there can't be a finite TC. And then also the coexistence of both density and pairing fluctuation can be used so that a weak perturbation, for example, nearest neighbor density interaction, can trigger the system to, depending on the sign, so here we were looking at attractive density interactions, that we actually find phase separation. So the system would prefer to completely occupy the lower band or have it completely empty. So now this sets the stage for the interest that we had lately. And that is to understand the competing phases a bit better. Do we need the topology for this physics to show up? Because there we know that we can't completely localize the orbitals of the flat band. But is this topological obstruction needed for this physics? So can, even in localizable setups, can the spatial extent of the Vanier states give rise to similar physics? And then coming back to your question, Jung, can the interactions induce a finite dispersion? And how does this relate to TC being proportional to U? Or even better, can we find a theoretical approximation or a description to get an intuition of what's really going on? Yeah, so to this end, we designed a model which the kinetic part depends on a parameter theta that we are free to choose. And then we have an interaction. And let me first state the interaction. We are interested in attractive Hubbard interaction, and we may or may not include density interactions as well. For the kinetic part, the main purpose of this is we wanted to have a two-band system, again spinful, And in this case, it's not only that the topology vanishes, but even the Berry curvature is identically zero all through the Poisson. And we can control still with theta the extent of the orbitals that span the lower band. So the dispersion will be perfectly flat. The Berry curvature vanishes, but the orbitals are still non-trivial in the sense that they have a finite extent. And also, when we send this theta to zero, we actually find a limit where the sites or the unit cells decouple, and we have a zero-dimensional problem that we know how to solve. So before I present the numerical results, let me actually say a few words about the effective theory that will describe the physics that we will be seeing in a second. And I'm using this small theta parameter to project onto, or to start from an atomic limit. And this theta also implies that the Vanier orbitals that span the lower band, this is represented here in this corner, would have a finite size. So this is the wave function. The center is constant in theta. Then the nearest neighbors scale linear in theta. The second nearest neighbors quadratic. But the main point is sending theta to zero, the orbital is a delta orbital, and I'm localized in one unit cell and one unit cell only. And in this limit, I can project the interaction to those orbitals that span the flat band. And the only term that I get is an effective, attractive Hubbard interaction. So there, I would want to have the sites either empty or double occupied. Now, turning theta back on, I can define pseudo-operators, because now, or pseudo-spins, because the effective degrees of freedoms are densities, so the empty or double occupied side, but not the spin. But in this pseudospin representation, we find an XXC model where the effective couplings scale with theta to the square, theta squared. These dots represent corrections from the second band that is still there, but they're subleading. Right. And this term that we find here, the x and yy component, is essentially correlated pair hopping. So similar to the spin flips that you may know better from the spin version of that model, here you would allow for a Cooper pair to hop as a pair from one side to a neighboring side. And this J perp will then also set the scale of TC. So I hope this answers your question from the beginning. This is the mechanism that the finite extent of the Vanier functions give rise to correlated pair hopping, and it's not a renormalization, or it won't be a renormalization of the single electron kinetic energy. But then, of course, I can drive a competing phase with JC, and this is also, if JC is equal to J perp, this is then representing the approximate SU2 symmetry that I was mentioning in the beginning. All right, so this sets the stage for the numerical results. Maybe let me first explain the data that I show here on the left, where I have the coupling strengths on the x-axis and then the critical temperature on the y-axis. And I'm analyzing the model for two different values of theta, which are actually quite large. So one is 0.75, where the approximation and the expansion in theta may or may not hold necessarily. And what we find is that the critical temperature for the superconductivity is, again, almost linear. Sure, there is a little bit of curvature, but it's scaling fairly linear with U. And the dispersion here is essentially zero of the non-interacting fermions. So it's really strongly interacting, all the way where the interaction strength almost reaches the gap between the two bands. And now, if I rescale the temperature and measure temperature divided by theta squared, then the two data curves fall on top of each other, which kind of confirms that theta squared times u, which is the scale of j perp, sets the energy in the effective model. To confirm this approximation that I ignored the spin fluctuations altogether when I derived the effective Hamiltonian, we can look at the spin susceptibility where I use the Hubbard interaction as an energy scale. So I measure temperature in units of u and also multiply the spin susceptibility with u. And then for both values of theta and of quite a range of interaction strengths, I find this behavior that the susceptibility is first increasing when I lower temperature, but then exponentially decaying for small temperatures. And in the theta equals zero limit, we have the solution from the zero-dimensional decoupled problem. And there we would have a spin gap known from the one-side Hubbard model, which is u over 4. But then I mentioned already in the first project, which was the motivation here, that there are also charge fluctuations. And this shows up that the compressibility, so the charge susceptibility, is heavily increasing when I go to low temperatures and then saturates only when I enter the superconducting phase. So at the temperatures close to the superconducting phase, to be more precise. And this is a sign for the approximate, but then not quite exact SU2 symmetry between the pairing correlations giving, pairing correlations giving rise to superconductivity and the charge fluctuations that remain finite. So the first data that I showed was for zero nearest neighbor interactions. Now let me turn on weak nearest neighbor repulsive interactions in this case. And what I find is that this weak interaction, even though u is 1, so it's 10% of the original interaction, is sufficient to suppress superconductivity altogether, at least at 1 electron per unit cell, and instead we find a charge density wave, which makes sense. If I repel densities from neighboring sites, I can very well have 2 electrons at one site and then empty sites on the square lattice surrounding it. One indication for the charge density wave is the charge correlation length, where this crossing, so if the correlation increases with system size, I'm in the ordered phase. If it decreases, I'm in the disordered phase. And the crossing between gives the temperature scale of the transition to the CDW. And this CDW extends to finite doping. However, if I think about a doped CDW, I can explain at least the data by having 1 electron per unit cell in the charge density wave pattern, and then interpret the dopant electrons as either electrons or holes, so as effective charge carrier in the background of the charge density wave. And at very low temperatures, these additional carriers can go superconducting while the charge density wave persists. And this is what I find at densities away from commensurate 1 electron per unit cell. And since we have the superposition or the coexistence of both superconductivity and charge density wave order, this is a supersolid where translational symmetry is broken. Right. Are there any questions this far? If not, then let me continue to discuss the dynamics that we have in the system. And here again, we will see that yes, there will be renormalization effects on the dispersion, but they trigger actually a different mechanism. Let me first focus on the first row and start with the upper left corner. What I'm showing here is the electronic spectrum along a high symmetry path through the prion zone as a function of frequency. And the main feature is that at zero energy, there is no spectral weight due to the low intensity. And the spectral weight that we do find is essentially sitting at some finite energy, and this energy is due to the pairing energy. So if I want to have a single electron excitation, I have to break a Cooper pair, and that is costing energy. And this is, and the same is if I want to create a hole, I also have to create to break a Cooper pair, and this is setting the energy scale of those two bands, and they are still flat. So this is in the superconducting phase with interactions, but the perfect destructive interference of the lattice so that I have the flat bands is still the case. And we see reminiscence at higher energies from the second band. If I look at the pair excitation spectrum, where put in a Cooper pair or remove a Cooper pair, I can see the Goldstone modes of the spontaneously broken U1 symmetry of the superconductor. And again, this is the area where we, or the region where we are close to an SU2 symmetry. So we also find not only the gapless excitations in the charge sector for the superconductor, but also a almost linearly a low energy mode that is pretty close in energy to the excitations in the pairing channel. Then let me now come to the lower row, and this is for the case where we have repulsive nearest neighbor interactions and we are in the charge density wave phase. And now we do find a dispersive mode here. The dispersive mode, however, is due to a term that I actually had already in the effective model, but I didn't discuss at this stage. And in this effective model, we can identify density-assisted electron hopping terms. And this density is actually sensitive to the charge density wave. So maybe I should go back. Yes, here. So an electron can hop from this red side to that red side dependent on the density that I have on the blue side. Similarly, an electron could also hop right from the blue side to the green side here, where it again depends on the density. Or if I tried look at this in a different way and I asked, what is the density that assists the hopping between those two red sides? Then it's plus the density here, plus the density there, but minus the density on those two sides. So the hopping between those two red sides is really assisted by the charge density wave pattern in the surrounding plaquette. And this is giving rise to the dispersion on top of the energy gap. So if I do a particle excitation in the background of the charge density wave, I still have the strong Hubbard interaction, so I break a pair, which costs energy. I now also create a defect in the charge density wave background, which is also costing energy. But with the help of this density-assisted hopping, the electrons can delocalize and win energy. And this is giving rise to first the offset and then the modulation of those flat bands here. So the Hubbard interaction and the defect interaction is represented by delta bar. And then this is the dispersion. And the bandwidth scales with the charge density wave order parameter and theta squared. I found this surprising because, say, I make the charge density wave order parameter larger, I actually reduce the interaction, the excitation energy. So going deeper into the charge density wave closes the fermionic gap. Or also, if I make the orbitals wider by increasing theta, the same effect happens. This led us to the investigation of the single particle excitation energies precisely at the gamma point, where I'm at the closest or at the minimum of the dispersion anyways. And while all the other data was finite size, finite temperature results, now I'm switching to a ground state method and look at the zero temperature excitations energy. And as expected, with increasing theta, or increasing the width of the orbital spanning the flat band, I'm reducing the single particle energy. And this dashed line here is a parameter-free expectation from the zero-dimensional limit. So there's no free-fitting parameter there. But then at some point, it's energetically favorable to reduce the charge density wave order parameter, which is plotted here, and this allows to keep the electronic gap open. But this is only possible to a certain extent, in the sense that, yes, the electronic gap remains, or the electronic spectrum remains gapped all the way through when I increase theta, but at some point, the two-particle excitation gap closes, even though the charge density wave order remains. So there is a second mechanism that the system avoids the electronic gap closing by introducing superconductivity on top of the charge density wave order parameter. And you can think of this as the charge density wave is essentially an antiferromagnet in this pseudo-spin XXY model. And the superconductivity part is a ferromagnet in the XY plane. So the system can go from the antiferromagnet to a canted antiferromagnet, where it reduces the charge density wave order parameter to keep the single particle gap open at the expense of introducing superconductivity on top. So this is a second way how I can enter into a supersolid phase. And all of this physics here happens at commensurate filling of one electron per unit cell. So I'm going from an insulating charge density wave to a supersolid by simply changing the width of the 1E orbitals. And I'm not sure if I'm going too quick, but anyways, this brings me to my conclusion, where I hope that I could convince you that we have that these extended 1E orbitals spanning the lower energy band, that they are a good representation to start the derivation of the effective XXC model. The assisted hopping terms that are also present are quite important. We can find linear in U critical temperatures for superconductivity. If I introduce nearest neighbor repulsion, I don't have a superconducting phase, but rather a charge density wave, where the excess charge carriers away from one electron per unit cell condense at lower temperatures to a supersolid. But alternative to this mechanism where free carriers condense, I can only also drive an insulator to a supersolid transition by changing the width of the 1E orbitals. For this plot here, I'm looking at the superconducting correlation length, and I'm actually using the 3dxy critical exponents for this gap, which also implies that the fermions are not critical at this phase transition. So, with this being that said, thank you for your attention.
Question?
I think Igor has a question.
So TC tracks U, and is there a way to tell what the superfluid density at zero temperature does with U? Is it related to TC? Particularly, is it related in a constellated Stalos universal way?
So, so there are two, I think I understand two parts of the question. One is the superfluid density at zero temperature.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
We have not in detail looked at the superfluid density, for example, in this for these sets of parameter at zero temperature. But we have extracted TC by the BKT criterion. So we did analyze the superfluid stiffness and looked for the jump height due to the BKT criterion of, I always forget, pi over 2 or 2 over pi T.
Yeah, one of these two.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So this is basically your definition of TC.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And, oh, right, and following up on this question, if I recall correctly, I think the temperature dependence of the superfluid stiffness in the superconducting phase was very mild. So I think compared to the transition temperature, it would increase a little bit, but not by much if I go down to zero temperature. So I would expect that the superfluid stiffness is a little bit higher than the BKT criterion of the corresponding TC, but maybe by, I don't know, 20% or something like this.
Yes, yes. I think that's reasonable because there are no gapless quasi-particles to really push it down with temperature.
Yes.
Everything is gapped, yeah.
Yeah, and also our interpretation is really that you have these preformed Cooper pairs because of the strong interactions there. So really what you need is a mechanism to trigger the phase coherence. And once it's there, essentially all your charge carrier goes superconducting. So it makes sense to us that the superfluid stiffness is only mildly temperature dependent in the superconducting phase.
Right, right.
Parker?
Also, what about the supersolid? I mean, when you go, the charge density, the CDW always has the same Q vector when you dope.
Yes.
That's pinned. So did you show any? Okay.
The charge density wave order is always at pi pi.
Pi. That stays until this big. I mean, pretty okay.
So whenever
when
I'm. So if I look, for example, at this phase diagram, whenever I'm below, what is this, 0.08 in temperature, I have the charge density wave at pi pi.
And it doesn't change. Okay.
No, it doesn't change. There's no, at least, there's no signal in the numerics whatsoever that it moves away from pi pi. The only thing that we do see, which is, I think, yes, is, so this is also the charge, it's actually the square of the charge density wave order, I think it's the square of the charge density wave order parameter at pi pi, that it is reduced. So this is the maximal weight that it can have at full polarization, and then it is reducing a little bit, but it doesn't go to zero when the 1e orbitals go wide.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure. Go ahead.
So what should be then the intuitive understanding of why in such a flat band there is superconductivity after all? Right? There is U, of course, that pairs the electrons, but you're saying that the superfluid density is also U.
Yes.
Right. So the hopping of these pairs is also order U. So
yes.
How should I understand this?
This is the underlying mechanism, and when you take the Hubbard interaction where you have four fermion operators C dagger C all on the same side I, and now I project the microscopic degrees of freedom, and if I now project the Hubbard interaction onto the Vanier orbitals that span the lower band, I can actually use the fact that the wave function is not delta localized, but that there is some overlap of the C dagger I after the projection to the neighboring site. And this is directly proportional to the weight of the wave function on the neighboring site. So if I now have, for example, both C operators on site I shift them both by one unit cell to the X, which is allowed by this matrix element of the wave function, then I have an operator in the Hamiltonian which lets a pair hop from one side to the neighboring site, which is proportional to U because Hubbard interaction was proportional to U, and it's proportional to the square of the wave function matrix element, and this is this theta squared term.
So everything comes from the interacting term, really, in terms of electrons, which you basically now is like a hopping term for the pairs.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a hopping term for the pairs also, but also there's the density-density interaction.
Right.
When I move when I keep C dagger C on the side I and move C dagger C to the neighboring side. And if the higher energy band wasn't there at all, or if I just make the gap between the lower band and the second band infinitely large, then these dots disappear, and I would recover an SU2 symmetric Heisenberg model in these pseudospins. And the presence of this second band, first of all, allowed the finite spread of the Wannier function, but it also introduces perturbatively an anisotropy between the J-perp and JC, and for some reason, it's easy axis, easy plane, so that the anisotropy favors superconductivity. Mm-hmm. Why it is easy plane and not easy axis, I don't know.
In fact, if I may say, in the old days when people were looking at superfluid insulated transition, there were lots of discussions along these lines in the presence of random potential. And so that was exactly the logic behind the papers, you know, that as long as there is some overlap between the orbitals,
yeah,
you know, at the mean field level, you always form a superconductor. But of course, fluctuations are stronger when the, let's say, states are more and more localized in some random potential, and that's how you can eventually lose it. Mm-hmm. There was an old paper by Michael Ma, Patrick Lee, that was discussing precisely this point.
I see.
Very, very similar, except that there was also random potential. So without random potential, they would agree with you. There is always a superconductor, precisely because of this XY preferred orientation of some kind of a spin-like.
I see. And if I was to dope the system away, so this expression here is for one electron per unit cell. If I was to include a chemical potential to control the filling, this would act like a transverse field on top of the Hamiltonian here.
Sorry, maybe I missed something. Why do you say it's SU2 invariant? I thought the first term breaks at SU2 already.
Okay. So, I hope I understand your question correctly. You are asking why is this SU2 symmetric invariant if I have JC, the same. This is the if you have the Hubbard interaction, you can write the Hubbard interaction as the density squared or as C squared, and it's still SU2 invariant. Which essentially comes from the fact that here I'm constructing a local operator or a local interaction term on side R, and I only have spin up and spin down as degrees of freedoms of the effective orbitals. So there's only one term that I can write down as the Hubbard interaction. So that's the same argument why is the Hubbard interaction on the square lattice SU2 invariant.
Okay. Maybe I'm confused about something very basic. So the eta xyz transform under the SU2 as a vector, is that right?
Yes.
Then the first term looks like some eta z squared. That doesn't look SU2 invariant.
Yes, but this eta c squared here comes with the psi dagger psi. And you have this of this effect, like here it's written, the psi dagger is d dagger r up, dr down, which is the usual Bogoliubov basis to get to the pseudospins.
Right.
But other than that, if I restrict myself to a single site, and I then only have the up and down as a degree of freedom, there's one 4 fermion electron operator that I can write down using d dagger up, d dagger down, d up, d down. And this can be used as a fact that to show that if I use eta x squared, I get the same fermion operator.
Oh, I see.
And this really relates to I have two complex fermion degrees of freedom, and there is one 4 fermion operator that I can write out.
I see. So you could have written that as eta z squared plus eta x squared plus eta y.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. All right.
Yes. There are two more questions. Yeah.
That's really related. I mean, what you just said applies to the U-turn. It does not apply to the second term, or does it?
Yes. Yes, this applies to the U-term and the U-term only because I am local, and then I really only have those fermionic operators.
The other one breaks SU2.
Yes, well, so in the other one, I can't play the same trick. I can't just rewrite XX as YY or CC. And this is only SU2 symmetric if JPERP and JC is the same. And in this case, this is only true if, of course, I don't have nearest neighbor repulsion because nearest neighbor repulsion only enters in the density but not in the hopping interaction. And I also have to ignore the perturbative effects from the second high energy band.
So you start with the topological bandwidth finite number.
Sorry. I wasn't clear enough then. The first project was topological. The data here, there is no topology whatsoever.
Okay,
the Barry curvature is ideally identically zero everywhere in the Brillouin zone.
Okay, but the Wannier orbital is extended, right?
The orbital is still extended, yes.
So then if you start with a topological band, then what would happen? Do you still get superconductor?
Yes. So with the topological bands, to be very honest, I think very little would happen other than analytically it's a lot more difficult because of the Wannier obstruction to define the local basis. But at the end of the day, what I really need is the matrix element on the first neighboring site. And if the orbitals can only decay as a power law but not exponential, that's a statement about long distances. It doesn't really restrict the value of the first nearest neighbor matrix element. And the topology helps in the sense that if I have a churn band, I know that I can't tightly localize the orbitals spanning them. So it sets a lower bound on these matrix elements, that these matrix elements can't vanish, but it doesn't tell me that much about the precise value of them. And I can have finite values even if it's non-topological.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Thanks.
So in a way, topology doesn't matter here at all, does it?
In my opinion, yes, that statement is correct. It matters if you think about how much you can localize them. It matters that I would have a limit where I can go to the delta sharp orbitals where I can control things. It matters in the sense of a lower bound on the localizability, but for the results that we have here, no. The matrix elements matter and not the reason why they are finite.
All right, now let's thank Johannes again.